Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Donald Trump's popular vote count continues to rise. It is now at almost 73 million. Kamala Harris is at just over 68 million. The Republican Party has also taken back the Senate. We are still waiting on House races. Over the next several weeks, we will be discussing how this happened. Today, we're talking about the changing media ecosystem and the power of the right-wing misinformation machine. Millions of people get their information from sources most of us have never heard of, or at least have never spent any time with. Elon Musk has turned Twitter, now X, into a pro-Trump echo chamber, and Vox's Rebecca Jennings is out with a new piece saying you cannot understand Trump's win without understanding where young men get their information. So what should we make of this? What do we need to know about all of this? And how can we reach people who no longer trust the mainstream media? And when we say mainstream, of course, that encompasses so many different media outlets. And then there's also, of course, the independent media. We're at a time now where people do not trust media, period. So how are you thinking about these issues? And I know that a lot has happened in the last couple of days. A lot of people are not getting sleep. They don't know how they're going to handle the next 4 years. And I want to say this is not about a Republican winning. This is about Donald Trump and what he stands for, about the rise of fascism, about mass deportation, about a possible abortion ban. So it's just important to note that. And I want to put the number out there. If you'd like to talk about just where you're at, how you're coping, how you're dealing with all of this, how you're making sense of all of this. And then the questions we're talking about today, media. The media has changed drastically, and we're all trying to keep up with it. I mean, we're doing it at KALW and the public radio station. If you're not listening on KALW, the public radio station you're hearing this show on, how do we keep up with the changing media? You can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. Today, we're joined by Angelo Carasone, President and CEO of Media Matters for America, a nonprofit progressive research and information center dedicated to comprehensively monitoring, analyzing, and correcting conservative misinformation in the U.S. media. Angelo focuses on right-wing extremism, online toxicity, and the underlying structures fueling their rise. Hi, Angelo. Thank you so much for joining us again.
Thank you for having me.
Well, you have been doing this for a long time. You were instrumental in the advertiser pressure campaigns that resulted in Glenn Beck's and Bill O'Reilly's termination from Fox News. So you've been in this media world for many, many years. I'm just wondering, how are you doing? How are you making sense of Trump winning the presidential election again?
I mean, to me, it wasn't all that surprising because I think that when the information landscape is the lens through which all these things take place. These campaigns don't take place in a vacuum; they take place in people's lives, and their perspectives are shaped by the media landscape. And so, even if they're not direct consumers, they're getting it through their friends, their impressions, their narrative about how the world is affecting their lives. Is shaped by the media. And so for me, the thing that drove me to the work and keeps me doing it is that it doesn't matter what the issue is, how the media deals with it or doesn't, is going to affect the outcome. And that's where the Trump piece comes in, because so much of the kinetic energy was, and so much of the narrative that consumers were shaping was really both was stacked in his favor in a way. And so, you know, big picture, it's terrifying, and you know we're a target, and so that part is awful because he will make a broad scale assault on the press. On the other hand, I think this is a moment, and there's some for us to consider just exactly, you know, the significance of communications, of how we actually, you know, shape that terrain more actively than we have been so far.
Can you give us kind of a through line? How are you thinking about how things have changed since, remember, Bill Clinton is the one who signed the Telecom Act, which allowed Clear Channel to buy up all of those radio stations.
Yeah.
And so now we live in a land of right-wing radio and religious radio.
That's right.
And then you look at the days of Glenn Beck, of Rush Limbaugh, of Bill O'Reilly. But even then, you were listening to a radio station and you probably got top of the news 5 minutes of what was going on in the world. And even if your friend was still only reading the New York Times and listening to NPR, you still maybe lived in the same world. Some things were different, but it wasn't as different as it is now. But now it's so different. So how are you thinking about that?
And I'm glad you started with the Telecoms Act and radio, because that is significant. And there has been a change. There is really a difference. It's not an impression that people have about the current moment. And one of the things that I always used to point out to people as we were getting into the election, we're getting closer to it, is that this election that just happened was the first presidential election in 30 years. 30 years, three decades, where Rush Limbaugh was not the single largest get out the vote operation.
Wow.
And so, and I use that as a data point because it is a testament to right-wing radio, to conservative talk radio, and also an indicator that we're in a new world now. And so to me, the through line is that you had the birth of Fox News in the late 90s and the rise of talk radio. And the combination of those two things created a center of gravity in a much larger right-wing media space where, you know, they were investing in papers and properties and they were building more talkers. They had talkers programs. They had training academies where you would go, and it was all free, and they would teach you how to you know, speak on radio, speak on TV, and then they would book you. They had entire book, all gratis, all free. Thousands and thousands of people every year. So what they built in the late 90s on the backs of Fox News and talk radio was a center of gravity that allowed for the emergence of an echo chamber. And what they did as a result of that is they were able to shape narratives, right? They would then attack other news media for saying, hey, you're not covering this important story you were talking about today. That's bias. And one of the things that journalists care about, appropriately so, is their reputations. That's their resource. That's what makes them effective. It's not just that they do that great work, but that people see it, hear it, read it, and believe it. And so when you attack their reputations, one of the things that happened in the early 2000s is newsrooms started to, in an effort to inoculate themselves from this sort of, you know, bad faith cries of bias from the right, they started to, you know, mollify their right-wing critics by giving more attention to climate skeptics or the latest conspiracy of the day. And that really did, that just continued to metastasize and grow. But to your point, there were limits. There was still a ceiling because so much, you still had some touchstones. You still had broadcast nightly news. You still had some antibodies in the system. There were enough people that were outside of those right-wing bubbles that were getting some good information, that they were, you still had a shared understanding across enough people that they understood the landscape. And what happened most recently, though, is the switch flipped. Because of technology, because of social media, you know, we've always had fringes in our country. But what Trump did in particular is organize and build power on what used to be considered the fringes. And what that means is that you have places like Facebook and Twitter and now X and elsewhere that connected otherwise disconnected audiences. So if you like a piece of content from QAnon, you start getting served more and more content related to QAnon. And what that means is that starts to create really intense filter bubbles where people start to become increasingly siloed. And you also start to grow audiences at faster and faster rates. And that is the landscape that we're living in now. There is no more unifying touchstone like, you know, some of these big broadcast news and papers. The kinetic energy that the right has created has finally succeeded in destroying and eroding whatever was left of the credibility of these publications, even though that's nonsense. And so there isn't a backstop. There's no antibodies in the system for the misinformation that they're pumping into the landscape. So the effect is that you have a very large part of the country that is pickled in right-wing misinformation and rage.
For those who don't know how big this is, can you explain what has really changed over the past, I feel like it's just the past couple of years, really. I love listening to health podcasts. And that's a whole other topic, because then you've got RFK, and that's just wild. I mean, people that I used to really like are turned into vaccine anti-vaxxers. I mean, it's just, we're living in such a wild time right now. But I spend time on YouTube listening to some of these health shows. And so I've spent more time learning about these podcasts that people are listening to on all levels. Like when Kamala Harris went on that Call Her Daddy podcast, that was something I never heard of. And it's a lot of women talking about sex. Millions of women listen to that podcast. And then Theo Von, Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump were both on Theo Von's podcast. And on YouTube, these guys get millions of views. So can you lay that out for those of us who are just not familiar with this world? And because we have to now really start talking about this and understanding the power of all of this.
Yeah. So, I mean, a lot of people, even if they don't watch it, know CNN, you know, I can name you, I can name you dozens of shows that had 3, 4, or 5 times CNN's viewership on election night alone.
Wow.
And people you've never heard of, because they've built an audience. So, Candace Owens, who used to be at Ben Shapiro's Daily Wire, is a perfect example of this. She had orders of magnitude more viewers on election night than CNN. And so, when we think about this landscape, it's not just the traditional sort of news programs. A lot of these people don't consider themselves newsmakers. They are like the analog to talk radio in the past. You know, Rush Limbaugh or, you know, these right-wing talkers, most of what they do is talk about politics, but they were doing 3-hour shows. What you have now, though, is you have a much wider landscape. And a lot of, because these people are in their own bubbles, most people never hear about them. You know, you would know about Limbaugh 20 years ago. And I use him as an example because he's sort of a reflection of that space. You would hear his voice as you were flipping through the radio, and then you would turn him off, but at least you knew who he was. You know, you don't get that now. As you know, if you're on YouTube, there could be there are plenty of streamers on these channels that have 2.5-3 million, you know, viewers that are talking about the same topic that you're going to tune into on another show, and you don't even know they exist. And one of the biggest pipelines for that has been sort of this sort of larger, you know, targeting particularly young men and other audiences, and they're huge. They're just enormous. And Joe Rogan, obviously, is their biggest right now, and he will average anywhere between, you know, 15 and 20 million subscribers. An average show will get a few million more views than anything CNN will get. He produces, you know, somewhere between 3 and 4 shows every week. They're 3 hours long. Theo Von in a similar place. But then one layer below that is you have a bunch of these people that do live streams. So they talk, you know, they're playing video games and they're talking. And so if you're, you know, somewhere in the age of 18 to 25, a lot of people say, oh, they get all their information from Joe Rogan. Well, yeah, but not really. Actually, they get most of their information from the person that is either watching a sports show that, you know, they're all collectively watching and they sort of comment on it, like Mystery Science Theater back in the 90s, or video games. And they're playing video games. And as they're streaming, they are talking. And they're talking about the latest nonsense with, you know, that they've heard or read about in the paper. They're shaping these people's worldviews. And that's where a lot of this information is coming from. So, you know, that the landscape is by far and away bigger than anything that exists in the traditional in the traditional media space. And then,
The Joe Rogan 3-hour Trump interview has received 46 million views on YouTube. He spent 3 hours with J.D. Vance, 15 million. Yep. He said he reached out to the Kamala Harris campaign and they asked him to leave Austin, Texas, because she was traveling the country. And he said, no, I will only do it in person. And so it never happened. And then Theo Von, I'd never heard of this guy, but he's a comedian. And he had on Bernie Sanders, and then the next week he had on Donald Trump. Again, millions and millions of viewers. He's got 1 million followers on Twitter. Looks like he is a Trump fan because he congratulated Trump and Kennedy and J.D. Vance. And he said, we invited all the candidates, but only three showed up. So Vance, Trump, and Robert Kennedy.
Yep. And that's the challenge, is that in this space, you know, because the landscape is so much more fragmented. A lot of these people are not honest brokers, right? They are ideologically tilted toward the right. And whether or not they feel that way personally, their audience is. And I think the Joe Rogan thing is a really good example of the relationship between these individuals and their audiences. Joe Rogan was a Bernie fan. Joe Rogan has repeatedly talked about on his show how he will not allow his show to become a tool or an instrument to support or help Donald Trump get reelected. The Trump campaign had reached out to Joe Rogan a year ago to try to get on his show, and Rogan rejected it and talked about the fact that he rejected it. And then when he had him on the show, he didn't endorse it. And it was a soft interview, sure. But the reality is, but over this last year or so, even Rogan's audiences, because they get their information, they live in bubbles elsewhere, they wanted Rogan to act and endorse. And Rogan was getting pressure. This isn't to defend him. That's not what I'm trying to do. But I'm trying to just explain, how does somebody go from saying, I will not let this be the case, to I am now going to use my show to endorse Trump? And it's because the audience is not living in a vacuum. They are living on X. They are getting they're hearing things incidentally from other programs. They're watching other live streams, and everybody else is talking about the need to get Trump elected, because if you don't, white men are going to be further oppressed. And that's it. And so Rogan ends up becoming, you sort of expect that of one of your favorite podcasts. And if you're him, you know, you're in the business, you know your data. You know, you look at it. He knows where his audience was. And he knows full well that if he didn't do it, he would have suffered as a result of it.
This is so crazy, because the AP reported back in February that Joe Rogan signed a $250 million deal with Spotify. Mm-hmm. I mean, Angelo, this is crazy. This is the money that they're paying these guys is so high at a time when independent media outlets, public radio stations, you name it, everybody's struggling to stay on the air or to stay in business. And you're handing this guy $250 million and journalists are losing their jobs.
Yeah. And it's crazy. And I also feel this way about, you know, that is crazy. And what I think is even crazier is that the Democratic Party as a whole, you know, obviously not the actual party, but Democratic donors and, they spent, when the dust settles, they will have spent well over $1 billion, $1.5 billion.
Yeah.
On ads, on slivers of attention that they know are just not that effective. Not because ads, and that's the challenge here, is that they are spending $1.5 billion to try to get a sliver of attention, of somebody's attention during these programs. And in reality, you could have taken half of that and invested it in the very thing that you identified, which is more media. And that's what's not happening, is that there isn't an orientation around that. There's this idea that, and look, a lot of that money, guess who it went to? The very same podcasters and channels and hosts that are undermining and attacking them and building the narrative that you shouldn't elect Democrats. And that's the issue here. There's certainly shortage of money everywhere, but I think that is one of the greatest sins of this election cycle in particular, is that there has not been a seismic realignment of where resources are invested in order to ensure us, you know, in order to respond to the current needs of the information landscape.
Right. Well, and then this is really interesting. Tom Hartman was recently on our show, and he was one of the founders of Air America Radio, the progressive talk radio network. And I did not know this, but he said what happened was Bain Capital purchased the entire portfolio of Clear Channel radio stations in the summer of 2008. And when Romney was challenging Obama, the stations that were carrying Air America decided to flip over to sports radio. And that's one of the reasons why Air America died. I just never knew the backstory. I just thought they just didn't have enough listeners.
Yeah, and the part about that that makes it even so incredibly more wild is you could say, oh, well, they did it because of the straight financial reasons and profit. Maybe, but on the other hand, Clear Channel still had billions of dollars in debt, and they re-signed that same year, 2008, they re-signed Rush Limbaugh's contract for $50 million a year. They gave him a $400 million contract for $50 million a year. And so those the debt for Clear Channel was in billions at the time. You know, you make some micro changes that, you know, stations flip all the, you know, sometimes, but Air America was sort of, the decks were stacked against it from the beginning. And I'm glad you brought up Air America, because to me, that is one of the things that I hear a lot from people say, well, we tried to build our own and it failed. Okay, you tried to build your own in a different landscape and you didn't adapt. You didn't try again. You didn't respond to the needs. Air America, you know, and I would also point that they say it failed, but I think there are lessons from Air America that reinforce the value of those in, of those investments. Because what came out of Air America are people like Rachel Maddow, who are important parts of liberal and left-leaning media media. And what for, you know, obviously, that's an example of needing a pipeline and a place for to incubate and cultivate talent for them to have a chance to then break out and build larger audiences and to get a shot. And what the right has is a series of pipelines that are designed to do that. And so that they invest in that infrastructure, and Fox being the crown jewel of it. And the result is that you get a massive right-wing media apparatus that functions like an echo chamber. And if you have an echo chamber, you have narrative dominance. And that's ultimately where a lot of these elections are won and lost. You know, I'm not into the weeds. A lot of what people will end up focusing on are these very tactical decisions of the campaign and whether or not they did an ad buy here or focus or give enough resources to that constituency. But I listened to your intro before about the state of the race right now. It doesn't matter what tactical decisions were made. They matter, but they weren't dispositive. What the results of this show, and I'm glad you're talking about it, is what the results show is that what we are dealing with here are macro issues, big things. And the biggest macro shaper is the information landscape that we're in. And we have to get wise to it, because one of the things that history tells us, including modern history, like we see with Hungary, is that the only bulwark against burgeoning authoritarianism, as it grows and metastasizes and takes over more power, the bulwark is going to be the types of information resources, the media that you have that is able to not only hold the line in civic spaces, but buttress it and expand it. And we are operating at an incredible deficit right now, and it should be a big priority.
Today, we are spending the hour with Angelo Carasone, president and CEO of Media Matters for America, a nonprofit progressive research and information center dedicated to comprehensively monitoring, analyzing, and correcting conservative misinformation in the U.S. media. What are your thoughts on this changing media landscape? What strikes you the most? How can we reach people who no longer trust the mainstream media? If you've got any personal stories to share about how your media diet has changed, or loved ones or friends, we'd love to hear from you. I recently met a woman who only gets her information from the Epic Times. And after the Lahaina fires in Hawaii, she said, "What happened to all the children?" And I said, "What do you mean?" And she said, "All the missing children, they haven't been accounted for." So, and then she brought it back to pedophilia. And this is a very nice normal woman, and yet she gets all of her information from the Epic Times. So we're living in a very different world now, and I think we just need to spend more time understanding it and figuring out how we deal with it. We'd love to hear from you, 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up, it's our media roundtable. Of course, we'll discuss coverage of the presidential election. Donald Trump has vowed to be a dictator on day one and has called the press fake news and the enemy of the people. So we're going to look back at the election and talk about how the media covered this election. Who did a great job? Who fell short? And how do you think the media should cover Trump's second term in office? We are going to do so many shows about how this happened, and we'd love to get your feedback. How do you want us to cover how we got here and where we're going? Next week, we're going to talk about why 73 million plus Americans voted for the most sexist presidential campaign in U.S. history. We're solely going to focus on sexism. And then we're going to talk about how the Democratic Party has lost so many working class voters. And then why did 73 million people vote for mass deportation? If you have show ideas, guest ideas, if you just want to share your thoughts, we'd love to hear from you. yourcall@kalw.org. And if you'd like to join today's conversation about the state of the media, where we are right now, and how can we reach people who no longer trust mainstream media? You can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. And again, I just want to emphasize, this is not about, quote, Republicans. This is about really what MAGA stands for and Donald Trump and what he has done and what he says he will do. The fact that so many people voted for this. That's what we're talking about here. Angelo Carasone is our guest today. He's president and CEO of Media Matters for America. And wow, Angelo, you and your team are going to be so busy in the weeks to come. You know, I'm having a hard time, I'll be honest with you. I don't know if I can do this for four more years. You all monitor this on a day-to-day basis. I just want to read a couple headlines to let listeners know what you all do. Close RFK Jr. friend whose account promoted, quote, Jew World Order conspiracy theory, says she is working with Trump's transition team. Again, another one. Potential Trump administration health leader RFK Jr. is working with a group that wants to stop, quote, evil and immoral IVF. Fox News and Project 2025 contributor Thomas Homan, if Trump needs help running a deportation operation, I am standing by. Before we get to calls, and we're getting a lot of calls, can you just tell us how you all do this work? How you monitor this day in and day out? What's the process like?
So we live monitor just about, in real time, somewhere about 58,000 hours of streams and radio and television a year. We archive and analyze about 1.3 million hours more than that. That's like, all gets ingested into a database, and so it's searchable. And so our process is, we start with the basic question of who matters and when do they matter? You know, 10 years ago, it was easy. It was Fox News, and it was a couple of radio hosts, and we monitor them, and we kind of get a sense of how misinformation flowed. Now it's not as easy. Now we have to sort of make some assessments on, hey, we have to pay close attention to Steve Bannon right now because he's the center of gravity for things related to Project 2025, or we need to start thinking about where these wellness or, you know, sort of health experts from the Trump people are going, because they not only have huge audiences, but they're going to have influence over the rest of the landscape. So that's the approach. And then, you know, we have a bunch of people that are doing it in real time, and they're sending flags. And then we have a big archive on top of that that helps us do research to say, oh, this thing that they're talking about, how widespread is it? Is this a thing that we need to start responding to or identifying or talking more about? And then the third part is, we'll either sort of push back on, hey, the news media is not talking about this issue, or they're framing it in an unfair way, or we'll write up these investigative reports, like the ones that you were reading and so many others. And I'll give one touchstone as an example. People by now know Marjorie Taylor Greene talked about Jewish space lasers, for instance. What a lot of people may not know or forget is that that was us. We're the ones that caught it. And it wasn't something she said on a big prominent program in order to get attention. That was her authentic self. She said it on a very, very small Facebook community that she was a part of, that we were monitoring, and she was going and said it in a back and forth exchange that she was having with another user. And so that's the kind of work that we do as a result of our archive.
Wow. Well, it's such important work. I wonder, before we get to calls, what are you hearing right now in the right-wing media ecosystem? I'm guessing they're not talking about how the election was unfair and how the voting machines flipped and everything we've been hearing over the past 8 years.
They are, in one meaningful way. They are talking about the absence of, somewhere around, 10 or 12 million votes that seem to have just, that have been reduced for Harris. That was last night. Those numbers will get updated. But what they're basically saying is, wow, there's so many less voters this time. Isn't that curious? Maybe what we said about 2020 was true and that Democrats really did steal the election. So there's a little bit of that. It's probably the second biggest story within right-wing media is that these election results actually validate that the 2020 election was stolen. And then the second, but the biggest thing they're talking about right now is revenge. And I mean that sincerely, is that, there is a laundry list of individuals that they are identifying as, okay, here's the person we're going to target, here's the group, here's the news outlet, here's the reporter, and why that matters is it's not just people in these sort of podcasts and shows that are talking about it. There is a very strong relationship between Trump's orbit and the incoming administration and this larger right-wing media fever swamp, these media programs. So when you sort of have a lot of discussion around it on X or on these podcasts or on these streams, it works its way up to the user, to say a Donald Trump Jr. or somebody else, who then makes sure that the right person in the transition team is aware of it. So, okay, we're going to flag that for investigation and that person's going to get a bump. And so what you're seeing right now is it's almost like them sort of putting together a priority list of who they're going to go after or harass first. And that is the biggest story in the right-wing media, revenge.
Wow. Well, we've got a number of callers on the line, so let's take a few callers and then we'll get Angelo to respond. Let's hear from Peter in San Francisco. Hi, Peter. Thank you for holding.
Thank you very much for what's being for you and this program. I agree with basically everything that the guest has said. But I wanted to mention three things and their significance. Section 230, monopoly, and pervasive surveillance. What we have in the internet is an addictive and non-accountable medium at the same time that we have a decline of traditional print and broadcast media, which are accountable because they're subject to, for example, libel laws. And the Section 230 exempts the internet and especially the social media folks from any kind of accountability for publishing what was published, what messages were published, in stark contrast to the traditional print and broadcast media. And that's Section 230, a short paragraph from the Communications Decency Act of 1996. The other thing is that there's more and more monopoly going on in the media landscape, if you like, online, where all the big wealthy corporations and so on are buying up what might be their competition, so that and that's why they hate the brilliant Lina Khan, who's the head of the Federal Trade Commission and is looking into aspects of monopoly that shrink the number of voices that might be there if there weren't the monopoly environment. And pervasive surveillance we saw from Cambridge Analytica quite some years back in 2016, when everything that everybody is doing online is surveillable, then the people in charge, the folks that have the money or the corporations, can get access to a lot of information that in the past they didn't. And finally, I'd like to say that the reporting in general, to my mind, has been very poor on history. In other words, what did Biden and the Dems actually accomplish, and what did Trump actually do? We hear about promises and campaign promises and such, but we don't seem to hear very much about, for example, the giant tax break that Trump gave to the wealthy and the corporations.
So
we don't
true.
Hear about Biden doing things that help people during the COVID that were sensible and not right. talking about bleach as a cure for COVID or a possible cure. Mm-hmm. And that's a disappointment because there is a trail for 4 years each for sure that could be discussed as an example of what one might expect in future.
Great points, Peter. Thank you so much. And we'll get Angelo to respond after we take a few more callers. Thank you. Let's go to Lawrence in Berkeley. Hi, Lawrence.
Yeah, hi, Rose. Hi, Angelo. I have some bad news and then some good news. The bad news is this, is that as long as you have capitalism and billionaires, they're going to outweigh us on the media because it takes a lot of money. And not only that, but the more inequality we get and the richer the billionaires get and the poorer the rest of us get, the worse the media is going to get. And if you think that, oh, well, we're smarter than them, I'm sorry, but they can use their money to also hire brains. So it's not going to change with the money division that we have now. However, there is good news, and that is that you don't have to rely on the media for communication. You can rely on face-to-face, nose-to-nose communication, the way we did in the 60s when we talked about participatory democracy, and you have community organizing and you have mutual aid. And I would like to ask you to have a series of shows, because there's a lot of good community organizers in the Bay Area, to talk about how you can get face-to-face communication and personal aid, one person helping the other, or 10 people helping one person, as I used to do with what we called neighborhood vegetables. Please, Rose, as much as you talk about the media and how to correct that, it's not going to be nearly as useful as devising the right mechanism for personal communication, and you can do that by getting all the organizers together and exchanging information.
Well, thank you so much, Lawrence. It's always great to hear from you, and we're definitely going to do a lot of shows about how communities and community organizations are responding to all of this. Thank you, Lawrence. Let's next go to Nick in San Francisco. Hi, Nick.
Hi, Rose. The one thing that I wanted to talk about was how I've just noticed that conservative media, I grew up listening to conservative radio, so my parents would play it in the car when they drive me to school, when they're going anywhere. And I just got to say, the one thing that they really get right is how to be angry and how to be disgusted. And that's, it strikes so much to the heart of what I think a lot of American people just want to feel like, because the problem that I see as a young person who's ingesting media, specifically radio and also social media now, is that the liberal media tends to bank on scaring people into action, and that just doesn't work, because who wants to be afraid? Nobody wants to be afraid. Everybody wants to either be angry or to not have to worry about anything. So just, I mean, Rush Limbaugh was always angry. Mark Levin was always angry. And listening to these people constantly, it just makes you think, like, oh, well, fascist media, specifically thinking, like, in a historical context, Hitler, he always, always, always tried to get people to be disgusted and angry. And that's what worked. And we see it now because it's happening in real time. And it's frustrating because, you know, you can't fight fire with fire in this arena specifically, because it always leads to autocracy, it always leads to authoritarianism, and it's frustrating for that reason, because the liberal media can't do the same thing. They have to figure something else out, because scaring people into action just doesn't work. Nobody wants to give up their complacency in that regard, and I understand why. It's why the conservative media, it's why the anger and the disgust fuels so much of it. And for Angela as well, I'm just curious if you've noticed that as well, because growing up with it, it's like, in hindsight, it's pervasive. It's all over that space in particular.
Right. Well, that's a great question. We did a show, gosh, a year maybe ago, about people who've lost family members to this. We had a woman on who lost her dad to Fox. He became so angry. She said, I couldn't believe how angry my dad was and the things he was saying. And she wrote a book about it. She did a documentary on it. She ended up getting her dad back, and he doesn't listen to Fox anymore. But this is a really important point. We're going to take one more call, and then we'll get Angelo to respond. Chris in San Francisco. Hi, Chris. Thanks for holding.
Hi, Rose. Thanks for all of your wonderful work and your guests as well. Okay, I'm singing to the choir here when I say there is a mental health crisis of epidemic proportions in the United States today. And to what extent does right-wing media prey upon that and exacerbate that? And I want to close with an Alec Baldwin quote. I'm going to paraphrase. I don't remember exactly. But he said, they have to hang on to their anger because otherwise they would have to deal with their pain. So my question is, how do we help people heal? I am a clinical psychologist in private practice in San Francisco, and I am willing to fold up my shop and go wherever I am needed if I can help to heal this thing.
Wow.
Thank you.
Chris, would you mind staying on the line? I'd love for you to give, if you're open to this, to give Kevin your contact information, because I'd love to have you on with a panel of other psychologists, therapists, to really talk about this, because people are in a pretty tough spot right now. So, I mean, I am. And we're also dealing with our own personal things. And I just think it'd be good to open the lines just to find out how people are doing. And I'd love for you to be a guest. You sound great. So thank you. Angelo, do you want to take that one first?
To what extent does
the right-wing media prey on this mental health crisis?
It does in a really stands out too, and it ties in with the caller before that's discussion about the anger of the medium. One way that they exploit and prey on it is validation. One thing that the right wing media does so very, very, very well is they validate the feelings and the sentiments and the expressions of intent that their audiences have. Oh, you're mad? You have every right to be mad. You should be mad, right? You're confused? Well, of course you're confused, and it's their fault. And that's the part that they do, is so much of their communication, you can communicate to people in three ways: to their gut, their heart, or their head. That's it. And whatever message you have, it's going to land in one of those spots. And so much, almost all, of right-wing media communication is to people's guts. Sometimes their heart, never their head. And that is a really important foundation, because what it does is it means that they are then able to layer, once you validate that, you bring them into the circle. Say, oh, well, this guy gets me. They understand the way I'm feeling now. And then what they do is offer you an explanation as to why you feel so angry or why you feel so bad. And, so many people sort of come to it. That's why so many people that commit violence or potential violence end up having mental health issues. And I think about that, the clearest example of that exploitation was during the whole QAnon process, where you started having increasingly people that really believed this. And as more and more right-wing media started to pick up the narrative and pull these people in, they led to do some dangerous things. They tried to take over the Hoover Dam. One of them went to a pizza parlor in D.C. and to do his own investigation. But they knew that what they were pushing was nonsense, but it didn't matter, because they started with that validation. Instead of saying you're wrong, they said you're right, and here's why you're right to feel this way. And that is exploitative. And they know what their audiences feel or need or think, and they push it to them. And I think the other flip side of that is, if you look at the products that they sell, and a lot of them sell scammy products to them, because they know they're sort of a little bit off. I mean, the idea that there was a big push of pandemic toothpaste that had special chemicals in it that prevented you from being affected, not just by COVID, but there's this whole through line within right-wing media that anybody that's vaccinated will transfer over these dangerous proteins to you. And so you need to buy this toothpaste to protect yourself. There's so much of this exploitation, but it does start with the validation. And that's where the last caller discussing about anger came in. it isn't always anger. It's emotional. It's high valence. And that high valence is really validating for the audience because they know they're mad and then they direct it. And, you know, I was listening to the previous call discussion about like history, and that makes me think we know what history tells us what happens with this. We don't have to theorize. I mean, radio, you know, the genocide in Rwanda, it is well established that radio there was the deciding and determining factor in the genocide against the Tutsis. Is that you had the Hutus have a radio that didn't just make everybody understand, they say, yes, you should be mad, but it's their fault. And that allowed for ordinary citizens to be radicalized in such a fast way that they didn't just turn a blind eye to a genocide, they participated in it. And that is not a unique example. The media does matter in this context because it helps to then direct that energy and that anger. And that is what is transpiring now. And they know it, and anger sells, you know, but it doesn't always have to be anger, right? There are other ways to get attention and engagement, and that's where a lot of, I think, the resorting, to get back to what we were talking about earlier, in the media landscape is relevant, is that, you know, the right-wing media's shows are really, really big, but there are plenty of other big shows that have way more viewers or equivalent viewers that are not selling anger. They're not necessarily selling flowers and roses, but they're entertainment. Most people don't want to live in a to see the world through politics. They want entertainment, engagement. And there are ways to shape the world and people's framework and lens with different kinds of programming. But anger is by far, or high valence is by far the easiest. And the scariest part about it, though, is to keep your audience engaged. You have to give them a little bit more each time, just like any drug. And that's where social media comes in, because social media does that. Is that you, in order to keep getting the same degree of intention and engagement, you have to serve people increasingly radicalized or extreme content to get the same effect. And in this case, it's them staying on that content as you did when they first started being served it. And it is a downward spiral in many ways. And at this point, it is being driven not by individuals, but by the technology platforms that people consume and engage with.
I wish we had more time with you. We'll definitely have to bring you back. What really strikes you when you look back at how traditional media outlets have covered this election? A couple headlines that caught my attention from Media Matters. Corporate broadcast news neglected to report on how Donald Trump's agenda would drain the Social Security Trust Fund. Now, we know that Social Security is one of the most popular programs in the country. You all report that news programs on ABC, CBS, and NBC fail to inform their millions of viewers about how Trump's agenda could imperil current and future Social Security recipients. Here's another one. Newspaper front pages continue to bury Trump's former chief of staff, saying the former president is a fascist who praised Hitler. But going back to actual policies, You all had another article about how Kamala Harris came out with a plan that would require Medicare to finally cover elder care. And you said that it only got like 3% of the networks bothered to even cover it.
That's right. Coverage. I mean, and it matters because, you know, these things, there'll be plenty of time for all this, but the thing that is so striking that's come out of at least the data so far is that people that answered factual questions about inflation and crime, like, you know, answered questions about inflation or crime and immigration incorrectly were universally orders of magnitude more likely to vote for Trump. And so what the media did failed at is, you know, too much of the side social stuff and not enough of the nuts and bolts. They, you know, they didn't talk about the fact that the economy was actually improving. The media also didn't explain to people that just because inflation goes down, it doesn't mean the price of eggs go down. You know, they somehow allowed for the right to, and this is where when the right has narrative dominance, they get to poison the well. But the news media never explained to people that inflation and food prices are not the same. When inflation goes down, it doesn't mean the price of eggs go back. They didn't get into any of that. They didn't articulate. And obviously, the campaigns are responsible for not touting their own successes. But and even if you take it out of the economic thing, which is more confusing, they never talked about the fact that crime went down. They certainly made everybody know that crime was going up. Even if you didn't experience it directly, that was a dominant narrative for 2 years. But as crime started to dramatically fall, they didn't talk about it. Almost nothing, scant coverage. So it is, we live in a media environment. And that, to me, is the bow here, is that so much of, and this is the dirty secret about right-wing media, about any media. People can talk about newspapers and how they don't believe them anymore, and they don't trust them anymore, they don't read them anymore. That's true, they're all declining. But at the end of the day, most of what is being discussed is recycled information that originated in good old-fashioned journalism. Mm. Now, they're spinning it, or they're polluting it, or they're clouding it, but Candace Owens, Daily Wire, they're not doing original reporting. They are regurgitating, spinning, and recycling something that they read in the Washington Post. And that is it. That's the dirty secret of right-wing media, is that it's not original. That news still drives the discussion, even if it doesn't have a direct relationship with its consumer. And so when the news media ignores it, in a way, it has a large downstream effect.
Angelo, 30 seconds. Is this the right question? How can we reach people who no longer trust traditional media? Or what do you think is the right question?
I think the question is, how do we buttress our communicators? How do we make it so that people that have, you know, and the first call is right, word of mouth is still the most effective form of advertising and communication. So how do we make it so that people that are on TikTok and Twitter and elsewhere that have audiences, that have credibility, but it's not their job, it's just something that they're doing on the side because they can't make it possible. How do we make it so that these people that are storytellers, we need storytellers. How do we reinforce our information landscape with storytellers? Not deceivers, not monsters, but storytellers. Because that is the only antidote to this right-wing sort of disinformation engine.
Angelo Carasone is president and CEO of Media Matters for America, a nonprofit progressive research and information center dedicated to monitoring, analyzing, and correcting conservative misinformation in the U.S. media, and also really calling out a lot of traditional media outlets for failing to do their jobs. Angelo, thanks to you and your team for all of the important work you do. Thanks for joining us. We'd love to have you back.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Thank you. Thanks to Kevin Vance for engineering our show, and thank you for all of your phone calls. Again, if you'd like to let us know how you want us to cover what just happened, you can email yourcall@kalw.org. Thanks for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.